When Sam Shepard's dysfunctional family drama, The Lie of the Mind, opened in New York 25 years ago, it won the Drama Desk, Outer Circles, Critics Circle, New York Drama Critics Circle Awards, and it is now be given its first revival here by the new group at the Acorn Theater on 42nd Street, directed by Ethan Hawke and starring the ensemble cast that includes Keith Carradine, Laurie Metcalf, Josh Hamilton, Frank Whaley, Karen Young, Maggie Siff, Alessandro Davola, and Maren Ireland in what Ben Brantley of the New York Times has called a production that connoisseurs of precision acting will be savoring for years to come. I'm pleased it has brought Ethan Hawke, Maren Ireland, and Alessandro Davola to our show today. It's a great pleasure to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Ethan, this is the second play you've directed for the new group. The first one was Things We Want a couple of years ago, and you've also directed three films. Do you like it as a part-time thing, or would you like to become a full-time actor, director like Clint Eastwood or Woody Allen or somebody like that?
If I could be like Clint Eastwood, then I'd do it, you know. The problem is lesser versions are less appealing. No, I started professionally acting when I was 13 years old, and it means a lot to me. But the life of an actor is a tough one. You're about as good as your opportunities. You know, that's one of the things that's really difficult about the lifestyle. And it's pushed me to try to do other things.
And make your own opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. And directing is one of them, because directing and acting are very similar. They're both interpretive arts. And every now and then in my life, I've had an idea about something beyond one character. You know, where this play, for example, A Lie of the Mind, really spoke to me in a way that normally I read things and I really relate to one part and I really want to play that part. But I became kind of obsessed with what this play was about, and it spoke to me as a whole. And that kind of lets you know that maybe you should work with other people on it and direct it.
Have you ever appeared in it as an actor?
No.
I
was in Buried Child, and I was in the late Henry Moss, two other Shepard plays.
The first and last New York production of this play was 1985. Pretty great cast also. Harvey Keitel, Geraldine Page, Aidan Quinn, Amanda Plummer. Mel Gusso, in his New York Times review of that production, called it a play of penetrating originality. So why do you think it hasn't been, and I throw this out to all of you, why do you think it hasn't been revived before now, considering how many awards it won back then and how well it was received?
I don't know. I mean, I think Ben Brantley made some reference to the fact that at the time it was a real event, the way that it was put on. I think it was like 4 hours long, and that the music that you were just playing on the air was a band that he'd incorporated into the show.
Which added an hour to the evening.
Yeah. And there were, I think, a couple intermissions, and so it was a massive, epic, sprawling work, which it still is in some way, but I don't think that after that production, given the fact that there were so many people in it and that the production seemed probably unwieldy, just despite its success, that theater
seemed difficult to emulate. Yeah.
And it needs to be done. I mean, we were just talking about this after the that there's always talk after you get a good review in a show about the possibility of extending it or moving it, and we were talking about how well it plays in this small little theater. And in some ways, I mean, it is a very artistic play, it needs to be in this kind of a setting in some way to work at its best. And yet,
I think
these
it would
size
work okay on a Broadway stage.
Well, it might be so, but these size theaters are find it hard to produce a. Yeah. You know,
the
big
trick
show.
I think is that it has eight people who have to carry the torch. It's not
equally.
It's not one of those shows where you can just get two stars to do it and then it just kind of takes care of itself. The play is kind of about consciousness. It's about an unwieldy subject matter. And you need eight terrific actors, and it's hard to get them.
So was that a casting situation? Or
it's always a casting situation.
How do you cast something like this? In the case of Maren, I mean, she seems to be specializing in plays where where things happen to her or her character. You were in Blasted. You also in Neil LaBute's play, The
Reasons to be Pretty.
Yeah. So you're almost becoming an expert in these kinds of difficult roles.
You know, it's funny because for me, it's just been what's the most exciting thing that comes my way. I mean, with Blasted, that was a project that I had been working with Simon Kane, trying to get find a production for years, just because I think that play is one of the most extraordinary things ever written. And so then that happens to be something that gets, luckily, a lot of attention. And Neil's play was just a gift that, you know, came my way. And then this as well. You know, it's funny because people, a lot of the time, I guess, can focus on what can feel like, oh, you're playing these parts that have these horrible things happen to them and trauma and whatever. But, you know, these are the stories that, that have the most sort of intensity to them. And somebody's got to be the one that, that gets beat up, I guess.
Well, in your case, Alessandro, this is a bit of a departure for you, isn't it? I mean, you've been in lots of films. Coco before Chanel, you played the romantic lead, even if he was not
very
the most
romantic.
Admirable person.
I had a mustache. It looked like Frank Whaley's. I'm really a character actor, and playing that kind of swashbuckling guy in Coco Chanel was in some ways one of the biggest departures from my career to date. All of my idols and heroes of actors are people who transform themselves a lot. Daniel Day-Lewis and Sean Penn and Robert Duvall and all these, they're all sort of character actors who've found a way to find stories that center around them, which is what you want if you're a character actor. It's true, I haven't played a part like this. I mean, this has stretched me as an actor in a way that no other role has. And
it's interesting you say you're a character actor, because some years back I did an event at the 92nd Street Y with three character actors, and they said there are two books. There is the leading actor book and there's a character actor book, and everybody wants to be in the leading actor book because that's where the good roles come. And when you discover that you're a character actor, you realize that you're never going to get the big part.
Well, I mean, there's a stigma attached to that phrase or that word. Character actor, it often means a supporting role. And I don't mean to say I am a supporting actor. I just mean to say that...
I was wondering whether you're destroying your career right here.
let's backtrack here for a minute. I just mean that I haven't played... I usually don't play parts that are very close to myself.
You play Jake here, who's convinced that he's killed Beth and retreats to his mother's house to hide. It was played originally by Harvey Keitel. Now, you couldn't have seen it 25 years ago. So did you even try to imagine, or did you just say, well, trust the text?
I found it very intimidating knowing that he had played the part, I'll be honest. And I did everything I could to put it completely out of my head.
He is unstable, often flies into rages, and his explanation of why he mistrusted his wife, Beth, is both terrifying and hilarious. And it must have a special significance for an actor, because it all involves acting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're referring to the sort of my second scene in the play where I'm sitting with my brother having just shortly after the event where I've beaten Marin's character up. And she the reason I did it apparently was that she was rehearsing a play. And I get convinced that she's sleeping with her co-star.
Taking her.
Well, he's obviously one of these people who's always convinced that the woman he's with is off sleeping with somebody else.
Well, listen, my wife's an actress, and I've been in this position many times before. I don't think she ever really did it, but I've certainly felt that kind of jealous
rage. Hopefully.
I haven't yet hit her.
Yeah. Well, as Beth Marin, you start off severely impaired, and then you actually seem to improve over the course of the play. Was this had to be very difficult. It's like playing a drunk, isn't it, where some people just play too drunk. You have to be very careful not to go over the edge.
It was a really terrifying experience, honestly, to try to approach something like this. And part of the way through it, I mean, for me, was starting with watching some footage of Joe Chaykin. Ethan and I talked about that early on, and Joe had suffered a stroke in 84, I believe, and there was some footage that I was able to find at Lincoln Center of interviews with him, with his aphasia, and it really taught me a lot, and it also helped me realize that what I really had to do was let the play reveal to me the extent of the damage that she suffered. And I couldn't put too much on top of any of the scenes because the play would just sort of resist it. And it was a very slow process for me. And luckily, Ethan was really trusting and kept encouraging me to take my time more and more.
You also have to, you find a way to make the audience love you.
That's nice to hear. You can't go for that.
But I thought really, the truth is I always feel like these things, you know, theater is a collaborative medium and we're about as good as our collaboration, you know, about whether or not we can set sail together. And I felt when I met Marin that the show had a guardian angel because I can't imagine doing the show without her. I felt that way the second I met her. Joe Chaykin was a big influence on Sam Shepard. He would directed some of his work, and I had known Joe. And a lot of people think that Joe was one of the major influences on the character of Beth. And it made it fun for me to direct and talk to Marin about aphasia and Joe and how I knew where I thought this was coming from.
But this is, as we said, an ensemble play. Eight roles are almost equal in importance, and each character takes center stage at some point. Is it tricky directing eight strong actors under those circumstances? Does it help that you're an actor also, and you've been in a major ensemble production like The Coast of Utopia?
I love ensemble acting, and I think any real actor does as well. You know, if you have people like we have, everybody was putting the play first. That's what you have to see yourself in service of something larger, you know, this event, this theatrical event. And we didn't have any issues with that. Everybody was, you know, Laurie Metcalf is a member of one of the great ensembles in the history of American theater, Steppenwolf. And so we have her there, and we have eight terrific actors.
One of them appeared in the original production.
I know.
Karen,
isn't that interesting?
She played one of the young people. Now she's playing one of the parents.
Yeah. Must be so interesting for her.
Did she talk to you about the similarities, the differences? She must have thought
a
lot
about
the play.
She brought the original script in, which we had in the rehearsal room for the first week, that showed all the things that Sam Shepard had cut from the original script, which was twice as long as the script.
Which was very helpful for us, because in a way, it's like, it's not like we were pinching lines and trying to bring things back in. It showed us, it taught us how he was thinking about the play. And it also, what writers often cut is backstory. So we could kind of, oh, that's how they met. Oh, that's what he means when he says that line. And Sam was right to make the cuts. But it was really helpful. And Karen was very open with us about that. I think the play means a lot to her. I think it must be very interesting for her to perform it each night, knowing that she'd been the other scene partner. It's very rare.
She said something about how that everyone's kind of, the voices were coming back to her, less sort of images from the original production or feelings from it, but more kind of, once we started working on it, people's voices just sort of started coming back to her in a different way.
Well, you didn't cut anything yourselves, but it went from 4 hours to 3 hours just because you don't take breaks for music and...
Well, it's the fact...
You're not doing a breakneck speed.
No, we're not. We're pacing it right. It's the biggest difference is Shelby and Latham Gaines. Sam says in his introduction to the play that the play needs music, and he had the Red Clay Ramblers, and he didn't know what kind of music other productions would need to have, but he knew it needed music. And Shelby and Latham are two brothers who have designed and built their own instruments out of found objects. And we've built the whole set kind of inspired by their sculptures. And so they set a tone and a mood for the play with their music that is happening simultaneously, and it helps all the transitions. The play has a lot of transitions. It takes place in many different locations, and it lets us bounce back and forth without doing blackout scene change. It helps it be one cohesive play.
Was that the way it was done originally, just moving across the stage back and forth?
No, it was done originally with this band that would play a song in between each scene or some version like that, and it added a lot of time.
Their music even... is incorporated into the body of scenes as well, and I found has been really helpful, even emotionally. And so, I mean, there's a series of moments in the play where I have these panic attacks that keep coming back to me. And whenever it happens, there's a specific sort of music cue that they play that's very evocative of the feeling that I'm going through. And so it sort of, I feel sort of...
And these guys came up with it together. That's the great advantage is Shelby and Latham were there for all of rehearsal. Yeah. So it's not like somebody's...
It's not like movie music.
It's not like somebody's scoring it later and putting it on. It's like if the actors have a problem with it, then we cut it. And if it's helping to serve the emotion, we find it together and it's, you know...
We have to take a little break.
Sure.
Unfortunately, we don't have that music. We do have the soundtrack from the original production,
which
we played a little bit of before, and we'll go out with a little more Red Clay Ramblers and continue our conversation after we take a little break. My guests are Alessandro Nivola, Marin Ireland, and also the director of this new production of A Lie of the Mind, Ethan Hawke. Stay with us for more.
Well, a man loves a woman, but his feet love to run. A woman loves a man like a flower loves the sun. They just can't seem to leave each other alone. They're like two dogs chewing on one bone.
We're back with Ethan Hawke, who has directed the first revival of Sam Shepard's play, A Lie of the Mind. First of all, in 25 years, it stars Keith Carradine, Laurie Metcalf, Josh Hamilton, Frank Whaley, Karen Young, Maggie Siff, and two other people in our studio, Alessandro Nivola and Marin Ireland. Ben Brantley said that this is Sam Shepard's richest and most penetrating play, a 20th century masterwork of a family portrait to be compared with Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night and Harold Pinter's Homecoming. That's pretty high praise. When you're working, if you were doing Long Day's Journey Into Night, you would know automatically you were working on a masterpiece. Did you feel that way when you started developing this?
Yes. I mean, for me, I know some other people also felt this way too, but I mean, I've been completely in love with this play since I read it in college, and it was always the play of Sam's that for me really felt like it achieved this amazing height it kind of wrapped its arms around all of these themes that Sam's other plays also deal with, but for me I always felt that way about it.
Did he get involved?
Yes.
What is it? Because he also has a new play.
He has a new play, Ages of the Moon, that's at the Atlantic, that's also terrific.
80 minutes opposed to 3 hours.
Well, you know, for me, to be honest, hearing you read that quote, it makes my heart skip a beat, if I were to be honest, because I believe that very much. But when you set out to direct a play, a lot of people tell you reasons why not to do it. You know, reasons why it's scary, reasons why people are full of the failed production in London or this bad production in, you know, this town. There's always naysayers. Even, you know, Long Day's Journey Into Night wasn't Long Day's Journey Into Night automatically. You know, when it first comes out, people are debating the length and they're debating this, that, and the other thing. And I have believed that this is a major, major play. And the idea that people are seeing that and getting that is really rewarding to be a part of a production that does that. I'd be lying if I said differently. I think for Sam, he's always on to the next thing. You know, he's working on his new plays, and he started coming to rehearsal, and then he couldn't stop. And it was wonderful to have him there. He understands. He taught. I think the production is fundamentally different because of his presence in the rehearsal room.
Well,
he did direct the original version.
Yeah, he did.
He occasionally would rewrite the odd line here and there, which was shocking to all of us. Seeing, we were like, "This play's been translated into 30 languages, man! It's like a Shakespeare folio." What are you doing?
It was incredible because it would be adding, you know, literally one word here and there, and when you get the change, you're kind of going, "Oh, okay," and then
jokes.
You play it. And it's, like, incredible. It transforms the whole scene.
The rhythm really was right. And there was a couple times, for me, the most exciting times were Alessandro would be working on a scene. He's working on there's this choice he kind of wants to make, and I see Sam in the corner just bust up laughing. Yeah, that's a good idea. Here, if you have this line, then you could do that. And he'd write a line specifically for the way Alessandro wanted to play the scene. I think he liked it because it was right for the scene too. But
so does this become the new official script?
I don't know.
I don't know if it's been written down anywhere except for scribbled in on the side of pages in our script.
That'll probably happen. But it certainly is rewarding to have him around, and it's certainly rewarding to have people love the play as much as we do. You know, we've spent months of our life studying it, so of course we feel that way.
And also I think that, you know, because the original one was such a huge monumental experience, and then for us to really feel like, well, this experience is its own. You know, it's got, there are these new little changes, and it kind of works with what we're doing, and it, so it feels like this is in a small way kind of its own experience. I mean, you know, differently, that there are lines that we're saying that were never said before, and that feels
special.
The best
one he wrote for me was, "There's room in my room."
But after 25 years, it's almost like you're doing an original production. It's not the same as doing another version of Gypsy or whatever.
Yeah. Or Long Day's Journey Tonight. It's there's something really thrilling about people just starting to discover that this play is a masterpiece. You know?
Well, Marin, some people have said that this play has more fully realized female characters than we are used to in Sam Shepard plays. Mm-hmm. And all the women have wonderful parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the most surprising things to people about this play. People don't expect that because mostly people have seen True West 3 or 4 times. You know, a lot of his other plays aren't getting those kinds of the amount of productions that play in particular receives, and so people don't think of, you know, there's even in a lot of other Sam's other plays there's some great female characters, but in this one in particular, kind of the equality, there's 4 women, 4 men, they stack up against each other, and there's a lot of discussion in the play about she's got male in her, she was all female, whatever. There's a lot more of kind of interplay between the sort of gender roles in this play in particular that makes gives a room for the women to kind of stand up against the men.
My guests are Marin Ireland and Alessandro Nivola, 2 of the stars, along with Keith Carradine, Laurie Metcalf, Josh Hamilton, Frank Willey, Karen Young, and Maggie Siff, in the new production of Sam Shepard's A Lie of the Mind, which is being performed at the Acorn Theater on West 42nd Street. Also with us is Ethan Hawke, who directed it and who seems to have really come up with a whole new take on this play. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you came up with this whole idea of having the same set all the time and having the spotlight tell us where we are at any given time. The audience catches on immediately.
They get it immediately, yeah. It's just setting it in a world that's cohesive. You know, I mean, that's the thing that makes the play difficult, is that it's a little hard to tell. Even, I remember, this is the hardest thing as a director, is they asked Sam for the program where the location is. You know, normally, you know, if you do Long Day's Journey, for example, location, you know, the family house, I forget where it actually takes place now, but
Connecticut
or something like that, and
near the beach,
and yeah, because the fog is always rolling
in.
Yeah, but in this play, Sam was like, just skip that. There is no location for this play, but that makes it challenging.
It's
as a
in
director.
The mind, in fact.
Yeah, it's in the mind. It's very much in the mind.
He calls it A Lie of the Mind. He could have called it something else, Troubled Relationships, or what. There are a lot of names this play could have.
It's about consciousness. It's about the state of reality and what informs us, and are we awake or are we asleep, and who's asleep and who's awake, and what do those words even mean?
Well, one of the heart of the play is about family relationships: husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, parents, and children. And dysfunctional is the word that people always use. Most of these characters have at least a hint of craziness in their personalities, and some more than a hint. Do you think they all believe that they're sane?
Well,
I used to tell the actors that every character in the play thinks they're the only sane one in the play. You know, that they all understand everyone else's dysfunction and madness, but don't see their own. Mm-hmm. You know,
The great thing about that is that everybody else in the play, whenever you're in a scene, is actively making it harder for every other character on stage at all times. So you don't have to work that hard to feel like you're in an asylum.
Well, there is a lot of humor in this play, even though none of the speakers intend to be funny.
But it is
and
very
at times
funny
the audience, play. I always felt guilty at times laughing at some things because the situation was so horrific.
Upsetting or
yeah.
No, but it's true. Even I mean, my character says all the time, you know, she's trying to make me believe I was crazy.
I know.
I think I say that like 100 times in this book.
And your character is crazy. I don't know. Maybe this is the first time you're hearing that.
Yeah.
So, this is a limited run, and. Often limited runs these days are because so many of the actors have other things that they have to go off to, and also because a new play is going to be coming into the Acorn.
Yeah, that's right. The Kid, a new musical at the New Group, which is apparently going to be really great also.
But it's sad to see something like this go. Does everybody want to see it transferred to another theater?
Well, that's always the talk. You know, you don't... I don't know the answer to that question right at this moment in time, but I do know that the beauty of theater is that it's a living art and that you can't go buy it online. It's not for sale at the Rite Aid. It's a living organism, and it's beautiful. It exists in the room, in the moment. And I know that I, for one, will be very, very sad when it closes, but it will close someday.
Yeah.
You know, it's a living, breathing work
unless
of art.
Unless it's God of Carnage, and it will just go on with
forever
a different cast.
And ever. And I remember one of the
characters... Tony and Tina's wedding.
Yeah, Josh Hamilton is in our play, saw True West with like Eric Estrada and Jim Belushi or something. You know.
But there are added problems these days. A View from the Bridge, there were hopes of moving it to another theater, and they just couldn't do it.
There's always problems. We would love to move the show, and people would love for us to move it, and we've gotten those kind of notices, and we're getting that kind of response, and I think there's an audience for the play.
We would want to keep everybody together. That was one of the big things.
Well, the trick is we're a band right now. We don't want to play without each other. And so we have to stay together, and we have to figure out how that can be beneficial for the theater company. There's so many elements at play.
So what does the director do at this point? You've got this incredible cast. They're working
the director
like a well-oiled
comes on Leonard
machine.
Lopate and brags about how great it went.
Are you working on other things?
I don't know. Right now, I'm so tired. I've enjoyed doing this more than I've enjoyed doing anything I can remember in a long time. This is really, this play is important to me, getting a chance to work with these kind of actors. This is what I really, it was a dream come true for me.
Well, Marin, I worried for you after I saw Blasted, because I can't imagine being in something as devastating as that. And then just going home and having dinner.
Yeah.
But what about something like this? This is also has to be very emotionally draining.
It's really draining. It is really draining. It's I'm not gonna lie. It's you know, Alessandro and I were talking about that just today. It's like, you know, you don't really ever fully recover. But the thing is that what keeps you going is you just want people to see this thing. You know, this story and this play. It kind of that is in theory what kind of continues to replenish you night after night. But it really is. It's
one of the hardest things I think we were talking about this about our roles in this particular show and the way that this show is structured is that, you know, normally your character has some kind of arc that builds toward a climactic moment that where your emotion comes bubbling forth and.
There's a release.
And in this play, it starts in the first scene. So we sit backstage before the show every night, you know, trying to get ourselves to that point right without having even set foot on stage yet. And that is, I think, one of the biggest challenges for us playing the roles.
You know? Well, you start off right away with an incredibly dramatic scene.
Yeah.
You and... The guy who plays your brother.
Yeah, and then and then immediately seconds later, she as well. You know?
Waking up from a coma seconds later. You know,
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been quite, for me, it was quite a is the word wonderful? I don't know, but a revelatory experience seeing this play, a play that I was unfamiliar with, and I agree, it is. It may be Sam Shepard's greatest play. Ethan Hawke was a director, is the director, and the cast includes Keith Carradine, Josh Hamilton, Marin Ireland, Laurie Metcalf, Alessandro Nivola, Maggie Siff, Frank Whaley, and Karen Young. It is on a limited engagement through March 20th at the new Acorn Theater, or the Acorn Theater at 410 West 42nd Street. My great thanks to all of you for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
So much. Oh, hard times come out.